It's 10:06. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen, we'll be back next week. Well, this hour, we'll be talking about questions. And that shouldn't seem strange. Talk shows generally are about questions. But this one really is about questions, because there's a new book by journalist Mark Kurlansky titled, What? Are these the 20 most important questions in human history, or is this a game of 20 questions? Mark Kurlansky is the author of several other books, including Salt, A World History, Cod, A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World, World Without Fish, and most recently the book What? He joins me by phone. Mark Kurlansky, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, nice talking to you.
The last time you and I spoke, it was about your book, World Without Fish, and that doesn't seem all that long ago.
No. I keep working.
you've been described as a polymath. Do you accept that appellation?
A polymath?
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
Really? Okay. Well, a polymath is a very knowledgeable person, would describe somebody, say, of the ilk of, Leonardo da Vinci, somebody who has a lot of knowledge about a lot of different things. You seem to write books that are that cover a gamut of subjects.
Obviously, I don't know a lot of things since I didn't know that word. Yeah, I have a lot of different interests, and I do a lot of things, and I illustrate my books. It's great fun illustrating this book.
Well, the illustrations are a lot of fun. I wanted to ask, though, to get started. As a teacher, I always told my students that the questions were really more important than the answers when you come right down to it. Would you agree with that statement, or was I steering them wrong?
No, I absolutely agree with that. And also, fundamentally, you can't have an answer without asking a question. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is it just seems there's an awful lot more answers going around than there are questions. I mean, a lot of statements being made. Of course, this is where we differ. You get to ask a lot of questions, but I spend much too much time making statements and not asking questions, and should ask more questions.
Well, I have to tell you that it was a challenge in some ways to prepare for this interview, because I'm used to writing out the questions, but you've already written them. So I was trying to figure out where I could start with this, and then I picked a word you didn't know, and so that was awkward. So maybe we could start this over again. How did you decide what 20 questions to put in this book?
I started by thinking about what are the fundamental questions, and the process is somewhat clear in just looking at the questions. The first question is how to begin, which of course was my first question in writing the book. And the second question is how many. And then, as you mentioned, I have a journalist background, so how, why, what, when, where loom very large in my mind, because I was trained that those are the essential questions. But of course, there are other questions. There are great questioners. But I started looking through books, and particularly books I admired, and looking for questions. And there aren't that many. And it's actually fairly rare for a book to begin with a question.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was trying to think of a book that I read that started with a question, and I could not think of one. Do you have some examples?
Well, a lot of Hemingway's short stories begin with questions, but they're not always questions that... they're questions that are designed, because he was a storyteller, to move the story forward, but not necessarily to deliver fruitful answers. I mean, The Short Happy Life of Francis Macomber, which I think is one of the best things Hemingway ever wrote, begins with the question, will you have lime juice or lemon squash? He wrote a story called Today is Friday that begins, you tried the red? So a lot of questions about drinking with Hem there.
Imagine Hemingway writing about drinking. It's hard to
right.
fathom.
But you know, those aren't questions that get you as far as some of the questions of Descartes or Nietzsche or Shakespeare. Was a great questioner. Rousseau was a great questioner. And it's interesting, too, when you start looking at literature and writing in that way, to see the use of questions, the use of, I found that a lot of abolitionist literature has a great deal of what you might call rhetorical questions, questions where it's pretty obvious, at least what they think the answer is. How can slaves be happy when they have the halter around their neck and a whip on their back? It was written by Mary Prince, who was a West Indian slave. So questions are used in a lot of different ways. But it struck me when looking for questions, Plato, of course, his whole formula was questions and answers. So that was one writer who always began with a question. It struck me when looking through this that you kind of go back in time to find questions, and leaving me with the question, are we still asking good questions? I think that if you, as a matter of fact, it's a number of things led me to write this book, this sense that we don't ask enough questions, and frankly, that I don't ask enough questions. It was a great pleasure for me to write a book entirely of questions, and for once not to be making a lot of assertions and statements.
You might want to be careful, because you know what happened to Socrates. I mean, you ask too many questions, and pretty soon they're passing you the hemlock.
Well, that's true, isn't it? But there's, you know, There's a reason for that. I mean, questions are, a good questioner is a dangerous man, which is also a point I make in this book. Garcia Lorca was a good questioner and was killed by fascists. And there is a whole history of repressive regimes knocking off people who ask good questions. People who live in repressive regimes learn to shy away from questioning. During the dirty war in Argentina, you never publicly asked questions.
Well, that's interesting. And you quote a question that de Tocqueville asked or posed in the 1830s. Can it be believed that democracy, after having destroyed feudalism and overthrown kings, will retreat in the face of the bourgeois and the wealthy? That's an interesting question, and one
I think
which,
that's one of the fundamental questions about America, a question that still isn't answered. You know, will this country ever realize its egalitarian ideal, or will it fall back on classism? I think that's a question that still isn't answered.
Well, another question is that's not answered is how many people still believe in egalitarianism? Some people see that as a plague.
Yeah. I mean, I was struck, you know, following this, the DSK case, following the DSK case, Dominic Strauss-Kahn's, And he was defended by the French philosopher Henri Bernard Lévy, who was asked the question because he had objected to the way Strauss-Kahn was treated like a common criminal. And he was asked the question, well, isn't this just American egalitarianism that you treat everybody equally? And he said, to my amazement, he said, well, everybody isn't equal. I mean, this man is not the average man. He's the president of the IMF, and he shouldn't be treated like other people. That's certainly a long way from the egalitarian ideal, which, you know, by the way, Thomas Jefferson got from the French, from Rousseau.
Well, there were a number of French who didn't like Rousseau either.
Right.
A lot of them with titles in front of their names. There was another question I think that's related is in particularly in light of the kinds of, well, I'll call them debates, but I don't really think they're debates that you see happening today, is a quote from Sense and Sensibility, Jane Austen's novel, where so many hours have been spent in convincing myself that I am right, is there not some reason to fear I may be wrong?
Yeah, I mean, that is a big one. That is a question that we should be all asked. You should always entertain the possibility that maybe you're completely wrong. Louis Brandeis once in New York City made a speech in which he said the foundation of democracy was considering the possibility that you may be wrong. I think that is one of the big problems with a lot of political discourse at this moment. I think that the Tea Party are people who are absolutely convinced they're right and don't for a moment consider the possibility that they're wrong. Although, you know, all politicians are greatly encouraged to never consider being wrong because it's a political faux pas to say I was wrong.
Yeah, I'm often reminded of the line that I saw in a Robert B. Parker novel, where he used to describe a character as often wrong but never uncertain.
Right, right.
That stuck in my mind. I find applications for that quite often.
Right, but don't you think it's important that whenever you're asserting something that you do entertain the possibility that as sure and as right as this feels, there is always the possibility that you're crazy and this is wrong.
Well, I guess anything is possible. I used to keep a sign on my wall. I don't know why it's not there anymore. Maybe I just memorized it. It just said, challenge your assertions or your assumptions.
Exactly.
And we all have them. And if we don't challenge them, we can run into error. We need
right.
to challenge our assumptions.
I mean, I'm not saying that you should always, you know, back down, you know, because you might be wrong, but I'm saying that you should always challenge yourself, consider that possibility.
We're talking about Mark Kurlansky's latest book. What? Are these the 20 most important questions in human history, or is this a game of 20 questions? Maybe you have some questions you'd like to ask. There's a whole book full in front of me. You probably have your own, and Mark Kurlansky may have some. We may not get another declarative sentence this hour. Who knows? But certainly you're welcome to join us as we talk about questions. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to join us via email, the address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also find The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Leave a comment there. So three ways to ask your question or make a comment. 800-486-8655. We'll have more of our conversation with Mark Kurlansky and your phone calls in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 22 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today on the Ideas Network. As the debt clock clicks toward default, President Obama and Congress can't seem to connect. After one on Talk of the Nation, dueling deals, default, and another congressional sex scandal, political junkie Ken Rudin joins Talk of the Nation. This hour we're talking about questions and Mark Herlansky's latest book, What? Are these the 20 most important questions in human history, or is this a game of 20 questions? Mark Herlansky is a journalist. He's the author of a number of other books, including World Without Fish, Salt, A World History, and Cod, A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World. He's with me by phone, and so is Kate in Menasha. Kate, good morning. Oop, I can't hear Kate. Oop. There we go. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of Mr. Kurlansky's books, and it's kind of thrilling to have a chance to comment.
Thank you.
My question is about questioning itself and whether you addressed in your book how questions may be innate in being human and how that may differentiate us from other creatures, how it's different from curiosity, if it is, and so forth.
Yeah, I do. I suggest excuse me. I suggest that it may be something innate that humans do in the same way that wolves hunt and pack and large whales migrate, that it's just built into our natural structure that we ask questions. I think so. Because I think that the acquisition of knowledge is a natural urge of human beings. And you really can't acquire knowledge without asking questions. It's one of the reasons why, as a journalist, I have had the fortune of talking to a very wide range of people, and I often find that among the most interesting people are scientists, and that's because the scientific method makes scientists really good question askers, because they always start with a hypothesis.
Yeah, that's really crucial, isn't it? If you, you know, forming the question or framing it, making sure you're asking it right, because if you don't ask the right question, your answer is meaningless.
That's right. That's right. And I also talk about the idea that there are questions that have no answer, and that sometimes when a question has no answer, it could be that it's because it's the wrong question.
Well, that's interesting. Kate, thanks for the call. Let's hear from Ray in Milwaukee next. Ray, good morning.
Wow, it's just a fascinating show. I was just discussing this with a coworker yesterday about the importance of the right question. But when you brought up that in repressive societies, people stop questioning out of fear for their own safety. And we are experiencing something like that in the United States on the question of 9/11. I really don't want to get into it, but that is definitely a taboo question in this country. Some people will automatically think you are a traitor for just wanting to question it. But I wanted to bring up something in my own personal life where I work on musical instruments, and I had a small ukulele, and the frets seemed to be placed in the wrong place on the instrument, thereby making tonation and tuning almost impossible as you went up and down the neck. And I asked myself the question, if I remove the frets from this ukulele, what is the formula to place them in the right place? And that led me down this road of fascinating discovery in math that I had no imagination at the time I asked myself that question. It would lead to all these other doors opening, and it was an absolutely mind-blowing thing to have come up with the question in and of itself, and it was because the ukulele was built incorrectly, and now I could tell you the formula. If you had a guitar 10 miles long, 1,000 miles long, or 1 centimeter long, I could tell you the formula where all those frets should be to be harmonically in tune. And I basically finished ninth grade. So this all came to me later in life. And it was by asking that one question. Maybe you could touch on both of those things, and I'll listen off the air.
Thanks.
Well, I like the idea of string instruments as a metaphor for asking the wrong question. I play a cello, and I don't have perfect pitch, and so I could hit the four strings when I begin, and they could be out of tune, and I might not know it, but if I started playing a piece, I would immediately know it. It's the, you know, the equivalent of, you know, your song isn't right if your strings aren't right. You know, your whole idea isn't right if your questions are off. I like that metaphor.
Ray, thanks for that call. We don't learn anything if we don't ask stuff. Why is it so hard, though? I know one of the things that sometimes frustrated me as a teacher was teaching people how to ask a good question. And why do we sometimes struggle with trying to figure out what the question is?
Well, you know, often that is a difficult thing because you're really talking about stripping away to the fundamental core of something. And that's why great thinkers are great questioners, because that's what a great thinker does. A great philosopher is really strip ideas down to their fundamental issues. And then once you do that and try to answer those questions, you go in surprising and often important directions.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not always easy to arrive. And often the fundamental question is just so obvious, we miss it.
Oh yeah, too obvious because that can't be it.
Right.
Yeah, we try to make things more complicated than they need to be. You ask a question in chapter 5 of your book. Could it be that it is less important to know which question goes first than to know which one goes last? The ultimate questions. What did you mean by that?
Right. Well, you know you know, I started with the question of what is the first question, in other words, the question that leads you to other questions. But then there's the issue of the ultimate question, the question that answering would really unfold knowledge. And you might have to ask a string of questions before you got to that question. Which is the whole point of the, you know, the Platonic way of questioning, piling questions on questions.
I had someone who saw the program note had sent me an email with a little story attached that he couldn't listen or call in today, but said that he had had a law professor who walked into class and announced that he had no answers. If students had come in looking for answers, he had no answers, and that he only had questions, and so and that the students were going to find the answers. Well, this sounds like, you know, Socratic method writ large, but he said that really confused him at first because he was used to instructors coming in and telling him everything, and this fellow came in and said, "I'm not going to give you any answers. I'm only going to give you questions. You'll have to go find your own answers."
Great way to teach. I don't do this that often, but when I do teach writing, I used to know Isaac Shiva Singer, who used to teach writing, and he'd say, I teach what can't be taught. And I always, with writing students, tell them that, you know, I can't tell you how to do anything. You know, it's not like being a writer means you have the secret to writing. Everybody has to find their own voice and their own way of doing things, and it's not so much that some things work and other things don't work. Anything can work if you can find a way of making it work. There aren't really any hard, fast rules.
Let's take a call first. Let's go to Marcus in Kingsford. Marcus, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question and a statement kind of rolled into one. Because we're all human beings, obviously we're prone to mistakes and errors, and we all seem to know someone who believes they know everything. But if the words who, what, when, where, and why come out of your mouth, aren't you inherently admitting that you don't know everything because you're asking a question right there?
Well, yeah, but, you know, I think this is one of the problems in our society is that it's supposed to be a terrible thing to admit that you don't know anything. Knowing that you don't know anything is the beginning of knowledge. I was walking into my building one day, and somebody pointed me out to somebody else and said, "Ask him, he knows everything." and I said, "I know nothing, and I'm not even sure about that."
Oh, you took the Sergeant Schultz defense.
Right.
Thanks.
But, okay. Well, Marcus, thanks for the comment and the question. Admitting you don't know everything, that's the first step.
Yeah, you know, we are all put under tremendous pressure, especially public people, you know, to never admit that we don't know anything. It's like, you know, you started by asking me a word that I didn't know, and all training and experiences tells me, you know, to fake it. And instead, I did the one thing you're never supposed to do and said, "I don't know that word." I think it's useful to do that sometimes.
Well, your publisher used that word in describing you in their press kit.
Oh, my God.
So that's where I got it. Oh, that's a great word. I'm going to use that. And, you know, well, that didn't work out too well.
I have tremendous respect for my publisher. He's a very smart man, and you probably should be interviewing him.
No, I'll stick with you. Thank you. This will be fine. You pull some really interesting questions from the Talmud. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the Talmud is a really interesting exercise in questioning and telling stories that ask questions, and everything in the Talmud arrives at questions and really emphasizes questioning. So that I tell the story of asking a rabbi. There in the Talmud it says that there are three basic obligations of a father to a son, and one is teaching the Torah. One is teaching swimming, and I never understood why swimming. So I asked this rabbi that I'm friendly with, why swimming? And he said, well, the Talmudic answer would be, why not?
Yeah, that's true. The Talmud tends to frame answers in terms of questions then.
Yeah, and it's really all about questioning and questioning assertions and how many different directions you can go in questioning things.
Mm-hmm. And you also point out the Chinese as great questioners.
Yes, in ancient China, I mean, they were great questioners, and one of the great examples of that was when the emperor called together what we would call today a think tank to study their monopoly on salt and iron, which was really, you know, the first example we have in history of state monopolies on commodities. And he called together all of these thinkers to discuss whether this kind of state monopoly was a good idea. And their process has been saved. And it's absolutely fascinating. It just goes in so many different directions. Asking these questions leads to so many more questions about whether, you know, it's good government to engage in warfare, and just all kinds of things just get unleashed by starting to ask questions about government.
Well, when you start asking questions like why do we need military spending? Boy, those can get you into trouble in a hurry.
Yeah, that's right. But of course, good questions do get you into trouble. That's why you're not supposed to ask questions in repressive dictatorships.
Yeah, or of the emperor, which I guess is the same thing. You have a great illustration of the golden rule. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the golden rule has been around for a very long time. Of course, it's best known in our society from the Sermon on the Mount from Jesus. But he clearly got it. A great deal of the teachings of Jesus come from Hillel, who was an extremely prominent rabbi who was around in his time, somewhat older. Hillel was asked if he could sum up the Torah while standing on one foot. He stood on one foot and said, treat other people the way you would like to be treated. There are earlier examples. The oldest example I could find was Confucius, who said it in a riddle. What you have here is the same answer being posed throughout history in different forms. Which leaves you with the question, what is the best form for...
why do we keep asking the same question?
Right.
Because we still don't have the answer. The answer to the next question is, when should I take a break? And the answer is now. We're going to do that. We'll come back and see if anyone else has a question to add to our list of questions here. We're talking with Mark Kurlansky, author of the book, What? Are these the 20 most important questions in human history, or is this a game of 20 questions? 800-486-8655. That's the answer to the question, what number do I call to get in on the program? 800-486-8655. That's toll-free from pretty much anywhere you can hear this. We also have an email address. It's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And you can also reach the program on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook fan page, and you can leave a comment there. So, three different ways to interact with the Kathleen Dunn program. Pick one and go ahead and do it. Ask whatever question you like. 800-486-8655. I'll be right back with Mark Kurlansky in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next hour, it's high season for berries and other delicacies. Larry Mueller's guest at 11 will tell us where to look and how to harvest them. And then after 11:45, Larry hears about sustainable forestry practices and research from staff at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. That all coming up between 11 and 12:30 today on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about Mark Kurlansky's latest book, What? Are these the 20 most important questions in human history, or is this a game of 20 questions? And speaking of questions, we have callers with questions, and let's start with Marjorie in Menominee, Michigan.
Yes, hi.
Hi,
can
go
you
ahead.
Hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi. Go ahead.
Okay, One of the things that I've noticed, and it's about young children, is one of the first words that they get to know very well is why. Everything is why. It's usually, you know, when they first start talking, you know, mommy, daddy, and then all of a sudden everything is why. Why this, why that, why the other thing. It can sometimes drive you crazy, but I've always loved it because I think it's just, you know, the mind opening up and they're just so eager to know about the world.
Well, actually, question 20, the last chapter of my book, is about that very thing. And the title of the chapter is, What Do We Hate About Children? Because why gets old after a while when it has no end? And the reason I ended the book with this is because what this illustrates, this thing that children do, is that there is a limit to questioning, that you reach a point where sooner or later you have to make a declarative sentence. Otherwise, there's no point to questioning.
So is because I said so an appropriate answer to the question why?
It may be a Talmudic answer. I don't think it really answers the question, does it?
No, it doesn't. That's why you use it, because you can't answer it or right. You don't have any shorthand for it. But Marjorie, thanks for that question. I have a suggestion for you. If you have an audio version of this produced, you should get Andy Rooney to read it.
Right.
Because he's always asking those kinds of questions.
Right.
You know, why is it that? Okay, I'll spare you that. Let's go to Dennis in Richland Center next. Dennis, good morning.
Yeah, hello.
Hello,
yeah.
Dennis. Go
Hi.
Ahead.
Hi. I've thought often about a question that Charlie Brown asked years ago, and that is, why is it that all the great communicators have so little to say? And more seriously, is there a disconnect between great speech facility and ability to think critically?
I don't know that I would say there's a disconnect, but they certainly are two different things. You could be a great thinker and a terrible speaker. I suspect that a lot of the great thinkers were terrible speakers. And, you know, as many politicians have proven, you can be a great speech maker and not much of a thinker at all. They're really two very, very different skills.
We're getting some really good emails. I want to share one. It's an email from Denny, who provides a quote from Bertrand Russell. Who said, the fundamental cause of trouble in the world today is that the stupid are cocksure while the intelligent are full of doubt.
yeah, probably. Unprovable, of course.
Yeah, well, that's right. Let's see. Let's go to Marty in Milwaukee next.
Yeah, hey, good morning, everybody. Two questions unrelated to each other. The first question, because I'm not familiar with the book, is Heidegger's question, why is there something rather than nothing? Is that one of the questions you've asked in the book? That goes way back to my college philosophy days. And then the second one is to expound a little more on this issue of why it is so hard to maintain a series of questions in a conversation, in an adult conversation about politics or religion. It seems as though many of us want to fall right back into no, you're wrong, it's this, and you want to prove a case rather than continue to tease out the questions. Just one other thought, one thing that strikes me about Socrates is that he always seems totally in earnest with his questions. They're not questions that are meant to be setups. They're not questions to which he knows the answers. He literally is asking the question to find out, and how hard that is for us to kind of do.
Yeah, wow, you've packed a lot into 40 seconds there. I don't get into the Heidegger question. I of course can't can't get into all questions. You always get this on books, you know. It's like when I wrote my book on salt, all these people wrote in about salt mines that were in the area they came from that I failed to cover. But, but what you're talking about Socrates and questions, it's difficult to ask good questions. It's easy to ask questions. One of the things that I learned when I was a journalist for daily newspapers is that if you were unscrupulous, you could get a story to come out however you wanted by the questions you chose to ask. And that part of the trick of being a good journalist was to ask questions that were not designed to get a certain answer. It's very tempting to do that, and takes much more reflection to do truly open-ended questions.
Mm-hmm. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, that's the number to call to join the program. There is a line or two available for you right now. Patrick has taken advantage of that fact. Patrick, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, good morning. Mark, I just wanted to thank you for writing 1968, and the reason is because I got blown off a hill in 1968, and suffered retrograde amnesia and a lot of other injuries. And it wasn't until a few years ago that I read 1968, and it sort of brought back a lot of stuff, and it really helped me. And it was what I really enjoyed about the book was the fact that you didn't talk about the United States and all their problems. You were looking at Biafra, and that photograph in the book of the rebel with the shells on his head is really moving. And you talked about all the other countries in the world that were going through changes and asking a lot of questions. So I just wanted to thank you for that, and I think you're a great writer, and I actually give your book away to some people.
Oh, well, thank you very much. There's a very interesting thing about that book, is that a lot of Vietnam vets particularly like that book, something I hadn't really... I hadn't really thought about one way or the other when I was writing it. Of course, my fantasy when I was writing the book is that kids would really like it. But of course, it was except kids liked it, and it got into school curriculums. But I think its book is most popular among people our age, and particularly Vietnam veterans, which is interesting.
Thanks for that, Patrick. Let's go to Carl in rural Winona, Minnesota. Carl, go ahead.
Oh, hello. Thanks for the show. Quite interesting. I've applied my quest or curiosity to looking at the meaning of words or the lexicon and vocabulary, and down to the alphabet. So the letter Q in question is partly rooted in the PH or PHI in the old Greek, which gives us physics getting two different points, but also in the Hebrew Kaf, which I try to learn to translate the history of... concepts. So the history of what's new goes back to NU, which aligns up with RE, and there's basic algorithms in language which tell a story. It's kind of fun switching around, looking for maybe one. Maybe I can elaborate them, make your next book.
So. Well, this is a great example of a statement that provokes lots of questions. I have a ton of questions that come to mind, but we don't really have time for me to ask them.
No, we have about 6 minutes, so ask one of them anyway.
Um, do you think that words are formed by chance, or do you think that they're formed with these calculations?
I feel the Pythagoras belief in geometric synchronicity and in the geometry was part of the formation of really a religious belief in geometry, and also that there's a truth to numbers working in everything too, so that any
in a conscious way or by chance.
What's that?
In a conscious way, or it just works out that way?
That's a good question. To what extent it's working out, and it's like a bird builds a nest, and it can be perfect and beautiful. And the question of intentionality there, then, is
right.
Well, see, we now have probably the basis for questions for an entire hour at some point.
That's right.
As the producers to take note here. In the meantime, Carl, we'll have to let you go because we've got a bunch more people we want to get to before the end of the program. Let's try Jennifer in Appleton next. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I was hoping that you could touch on the connection between fear and asking questions, and that stopping people from asking questions in the first place, and then perhaps directing what sorts of questions people might ask because they may be afraid of the answers they will get.
Yes, well, this goes back to what we were talking about before of why question asking is not popular in repressive regimes. The man who asks good questions is a dangerous person. And men and women who ask good questions often get into trouble. History is full of examples of that. We don't miss that, and we tend to shy away from really tough, hard questions.
Well, why do we perceive questions as threats?
Well, partly because history shows that they are perceived that way, but it's not so much perception as the fact they truly are threats.
Oh, okay.
You know, if you ask why is something done in a certain way, what is this? These are questions that go to the core of establishments. And I very much like the old 60s idea that doesn't get talked about very much anymore about pro- and anti-establishment thinking. And anti-establishment thinking, where you take on establishments, is all about asking questions. So if you are an establishment and you fear being removed or the order being changed on you, then you will fear people who question it.
All right. Well, let's go to Ken and give him the last question. Ken, go ahead.
Hi. I was interested in what you said about the press and open-ended questions versus leading or biased questions. I was wondering if there's a framework for which you can pretty easily tell whether a question is fair or not, and whether it's biased or not. And I've often said that if the press were held to higher standards, it would solve some of the problems in public discourse we have in this country. And if there was a standard framework under which a person who's being questioned could say, that's not a fair question, it's biased, and here's why it's biased. And if people who are being interviewed or could hold the press to those standards, would it kind of improve discourse?
You got about a minute.
Well, I agree. It would improve discourse, and people in public life, particularly politicians, are so focused on being the person with the answer, and they're so programmed to answer anything that they don't question the questions nearly enough, although I'm sure they are often aware that it is a biased question and an unfair question designed to get something that they're going for rather than find out information. I mean, if you just look at press conferences, rarely are questions asked in press conferences that are really designed to improve our knowledge. It's try to trap the politician.
Well, of course, lawyers are trained never to ask questions that they don't already know the answers to.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, because if you ask a question you don't know the answer, you might not get the answer you're looking for.
That's right.
Well, Mark Kurlansky, a fascinating book and a fascinating conversation. What's your next book going to be?
My next book is a biography of Clarence Birdseye, the inventor of the industrial process for frozen food, and a very interesting man who was born in 1886 at the height of the Industrial Revolution. And contrary to today's thinking, I mean, he was kind of a foodie in that he loved food, but he believed that the greatest thing that could happen to food was for it to be industrialized.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing it. Thank you for joining me this morning.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Mark Kurlansky, journalist, author of a gaggle of books, at least, including What? This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. Chrissy Pease handled on-air production. I'm John Munson, and for Kathleen Dunn, it's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.